Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2009 Minnesota Summit to Prevent Sexual Violence. Eric Janis, President and Dean of the William Mitchell College of Law, discusses public policy implications of the current approach in dealing with sexual violence.
You know, it's really tempting to think that the design of anti-sexual violence policy is easy and straightforward. We often tell ourselves we are going to spare no expense because the safety of any child, any woman, any person, their safety, their life is priceless. And we sometimes design our public policy taking into account the truth underlying that sort of statement. We know that sexual abuse is terribly harmful to victims. We know it's terribly expensive for society. We know it's ubiquitous. And we are right to express our concern and our outrage. And we often do that through the normative balancing in our criminal law and the laws we design. But you know, it turns out it's not so easy. When we say we spare no expense, it's a symbolic statement, but it's false. Cost does make a difference. We know particularly now, but always, public resources are limited. And our public policy choices make a difference. They make a real difference in lives and safety. So if we really care about preventing the most sexual violence, and I know all of us here do, we really care about engendering the most safety, we need to be really deliberate and mindful in our policymaking. If we get the answers wrong, it costs. What I want to talk about this morning is the idea of framing. How are we framing the questions we're asking? And I want to suggest that as we frame the questions, we determine the answer. And the answers we get depend on how we frame. Frames are set by our leaders, by our media, by how we talk about sexual violence. And I want to talk about what I think some of the common frames are that we use when we talk about sexual violence and make some suggestions for what frames we ought to be using, how we ought to be changing our framework for thinking about sexual violence. And I want to begin by talking about one of the frames that has come to dominate our discussion and our public policy over the past two decades, and that's the idea of recidivism. By recidivism, what I mean is the notion that a person who's been convicted of a sexual crime goes out and commits another sexual crime. What I want to suggest is that over the past couple of decades, a lot of our public policy, a lot of the laws we've enacted, one of the things I want to suggest is that it's really important to follow the dollars here. A lot of the resources, in fact, the majority of the resources publicly have gone in an effort to combat recidivist sexual violence. This idea of recidivism underlies the development of our so-called sexually violent predator laws, civil commitment laws, Megan's laws, residential restrictions on sex offenders, and such creative schemes as forcing sex offenders to use pink license plates, stay inside on Halloween, and stay out of hurricane shelters. This is how the media frames the problem, that molesters often strike again. This idea of recidivism, as I say, has been the underlying idea, the underlying motive force for many of the laws. A draft bill in Minnesota several years ago, for example, set increasing sentences for sex offenders, declared that sex offenders are particularly likely to be dangerous after their release from imprisonment. The Florida Sexual Predators Act said, sex offenders are extremely likely to use physical violence and to repeat their offenses. As you look at the legislation we've passed, it's almost all of it has been based on this idea of high recidivism. I want to say three things. First of all, I don't want to minimize the problem of recidivist violence. That's not my point. I want to make two points. One is that as we design our policy, very important to be aware of what the facts really are. And the second point I want to make is to demonstrate for you how this particular choice of a frame, the idea of preventing recidivist violence, has had a fateful consequence for us as we've designed our policy. Okay, first of all, it turns out that this idea that all sex offenders are recidivists, or that most of them are, isn't really true. A key study done by the Department of Justice followed about 10,000 offenders released from prison in 1994. They followed them for 3 years. And what they found was that almost 95% of these offenders were not arrested for another sex offense. In other words, 95% of these folks were not recidivists. Recidivism for a new sex crime for these 10,000 sex offenders was about 5.3%. Child molesters were rearrested at an even lower rate, 3.3% in 3 years. Turned out in the study that sex offenders have a same crime reoffense rate that's among the lowest for criminals. And sex offenders have an any crime reoffense rate among the lowest for all criminals. Now, on the other hand, the study found that the sex offenders who were released from prison were, and this makes a lot of sense, were four times more likely to be rearrested for a new sex crime than were the non-sex offenders who were simultaneously in prison. And that statistic, the notion that sex offenders being released from prison are four times more likely to commit a sex crime, then became the basis for a number of pieces of legislation, which again cited this notion that sex offenders are highly likely to be recidivists. But here's the point I want to make. The study, which again, focused on sex offenders and non-sex offenders being released from prison, while it found that non-sex offenders had a lower rate of committing sexual crimes when they were released, since there were more of them, they actually committed more sexual crimes than the sex offenders who were released. So if you look at the sex crimes committed by released prisoners, only a small fraction of those sex crimes were recidivist sexual crimes. Most of the sexual crimes committed by released prisoners were committed by non-sexual recidivists. They were committed by non-sex offenders. And here's another interesting way of looking at this. You take a look at the population of sex offenders in prison, and you ask, how many of those people who are the most serious sex offenders, the ones who've been detected and prosecuted and sentenced and sent to prison, how many of those folks are recidivist sex offenders? The answer is about 1 in 7 or 1 in 10, depending on how you look at it. Again, most of the sex criminals in prison are not recidivists, in the sense that their sexual crime is not a recidivist crime. So the point here is that not that recidivism is unimportant, not that any of these crimes are harmless. The point is that recidivist sex crime is a small part of the problem. Again, same charts. We look at sex crime. Most sex crime is committed by people who have not previously been in the criminal justice system. In Minnesota, we have a very expensive program called the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, multiple million dollars, that's designed to incapacitate the worst of the worst. But if you take a look at the numbers again, you'll see that most recidivists are not committed. Most recidivists are returned to the community. So recidivist sex crime is a small part of the problem. What does that mean? What are the implications? Well, we ought to take a look at the stream that leads from root causes to sexual violence. And this is an estimate, probably not a very good estimate, but an estimate I did a number of years ago. And it probably underestimates. If you look left-hand side of the chart, it's an estimate of the number of sexual assaults in Minnesota every year. I estimated about 12,000, and it's probably an underestimate. About half of those are unreported. Of those reported, only a fraction are cleared by police. Of those cleared, only a fraction are convicted. Of those convicted, many go on probation. Only a fraction go to prison. And only a small fraction of the people released from prison are sent to Moose Lake or St. Peter for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The point is that most of the problem of sexual violence is in the community, not in the criminal justice system. And to the extent that we focus on recidivism, we're ignoring a huge part of the problem. And most of all, to the extent we're focusing on recidivism only, we're focusing way downstream, and we're ignoring the root causes. So I want to suggest what I think the current frames are that we generally are using to think about sexual violence, and then how I think we need to change the frame. So current frames, recidivism, I've just talked about that, and I've talked about how that pushes our thinking downstream. Second, you remember the quote I put up from the Attorney General in South Carolina, this notion of perverts. Think about how often you see the term sexual predator in the paper and how we've come to characterize the sex offender or the problem of sexual violence as the problem of the sexual predator. But I want to suggest that that frame is misleading too, because sexual predator suggests the man in the trench coat waiting in the dark parking lot. And we know that that is not the norm for sexual violence. The norm for sexual violence is acquaintance and relatives and people known to the victim. Thirdly, we tend to think of designing our sexual violence policy as closing the loopholes. We all become aware of a terrible crime, and we ask ourselves, how could that person have been released from prison to commit this crime? How could we not have detected that? We've got to change our policy so that every last dangerous person is not released from prison. So we're forever trying to figure out what those loopholes are and close them. It's a very specific mentality. We think that we are sparing no expense, but really we are sparing a lot of expense. And what we mean when we say we spare no expense is that we're going to spare no expense on the highly visible but atypical kind of sexual crimes. And we are going to pinch our pennies when it comes to the most ubiquitous and common sort of sexual violence. We think in terms of ritual exile. If only we can figure out who these dangerous people are and make them put a pink license plate on their car or keep them living in a separate neighborhood, not in our neighborhood, send them away somewhere, then we think we can solve the problem. And finally, we keep thinking about who are the most dangerous people and what can we do to find them and send them away. So here's where I suggest we need some new frames. Instead of solely focusing on who are the most dangerous people, let's focus on where the most danger lies and how we can address the most danger. Instead of forever thinking that we can find that last loophole in the law and close it, we have to move to a much more systemic and comprehensive approach to preventing sexual violence. Instead of thinking about sex offenders as this archetypical sexual predator, this stranger rapist, whom we're going to find and exile from our community, we need to begin to own the problem. We need to think of sexual violence not in terms of them, those people, but in terms of us and in terms of how our social values condone and allow sexual violence to flourish. And lastly, we need to be switching from downstream solutions and a downstream focus to a public health approach. And here's what I want to close by saying, just a word about a public health approach and what that entails. Number one, it's data-based. And it focuses on what kind of information we have about the problem, the incidence of the problem, the commonness of it, its patterns, what are the most common sorts of sexual violence. So we need to develop the data, and then we need to pay attention to it, and we need to design our public policy with an awareness of what the empirical information is. Second of all, we need to be comprehensive. Public health approaches don't rely on one solution alone. They understand that comprehensiveness and systematic approaches are necessary. They look at three sorts of interventions. They look at primary interventions, which attempt to understand the root causes of the problem and intervene before violence occurs. They look at secondary approaches, and by that I mean approaches dealing with identified sexual offenders. And they make use of these secondary approaches that are not very exciting, but they're tried and true. They're about containment. They're about supervision. They're about treatment. They're about dealing with people who are known offenders. And yes, they also look at tertiary approaches, the downstream approaches dealing with the most dangerous people. But they don't only look at tertiary approaches. And finally, public health approaches evaluate and assess, and they understand. They're seeking best practices. They're seeking to understand what practices work. And then they're seeking to spread those practices, to multiply them and amplify them. The final point I want to make, again, is that we need to change the frame from thinking that sexual violence is like a discrete cancer, that if we could only find the bad people and send them away, we've got the problem licked, and we have to understand that it's a systematic, ubiquitous problem in our society, and it's only going to be changed when we eliminate the root causes that allow it to flourish. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.